This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. My co-host Craig Blumenschein has the day off. Coming up in the second half of today's show, it's Prairie Plates with Rick Guillon as we talk about celebrating Asian culture. But we are going to start today talking with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. He is the host of Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life and a professor of philosophy at the University of North Dakota, and he joins us once a month for Philosophical Currents as we take a philosophical deep dive into news and current events. And with Memorial Day right behind us, it is officially the summer travel season. But if you have your cell phone with you and your cell phone is connected to your work email and your Facebook and your Insta and it's constantly dinging and you're constantly checking, or maybe you're one of those people who brings a laptop on vacation or calls into the office, or I once even had a news director who came to work on vacation in jeans. I guess that counted. What is happening when we rest, and what's happening if we don't rest, and maybe even more importantly, with all of this connectedness, can we even rest? Jack, thanks so much for joining us today.
I am happy to be here, and this is a question I've thought a lot about. My daughter turned 18, and she's about to go to college, and we're about to be empty nesters, and you'd think we'd have more time. You'd think we'd have more energy.
She's not gone yet.
Oh, I understand, but everything seems to add more stuff to do. Everything seems to just, there's more stuff on the list, and I don't even think I know what rest means anymore.
Hmm. Well, I will just say that I am also an empty nester. One, I chose right away to use the term empty zester because I liked the idea that, you know, you can add a little bit of zest and flair to your life when you're not under that sort of constant parental stress. And then I actually settled on the term mother emerita because I thought that it added all of the bona fides and no more of the work. And, you know, you will find that time, Jack. But that's intriguing that, you know, she's not even out of the house yet, and you are already saying, I don't know if I'm going to have more time. So let's go ahead and start there. The fact that when we are even faced with the idea of rest in the United States, we panic.
I think that's actually a really good use of the term. I think we do panic because I think many of us, we need to fill our time. We need to know that the trip is going to be organized. We need to know that we're getting a good price on the ticket. That the idea of just sitting around and doing nothing is completely foreign to us. And I don't mean, as I think a lot of people will pop into their heads, I don't mean sitting and watching TV. I don't mean vegging out while something is going on around you. I mean lying in silence, closing our eyes, hanging out in the hammock, not talking to anybody or listening to anybody. Just this idea that we can recharge in neutral without stimulation and without sensation. That's the normative idea of rest. That's the basic starting point, that what rest means is a downtime for you and your body and your mind, and that you have to find a stillness and a centeredness about it. And that is something that in particular, Americans are bad at.
Well, let's talk about a little bit more about that idea, because there is sort of this nirvana. One of the translations I've heard of this word is mind nakedness. And I'm speaking here as I'm also a yoga instructor. Speaking of being constantly busy, yeah, I have a couple of jobs. you know, we often tell our students that it's not about having nothing in your mind. It's about having thoughts that are helpful to you and sort of concentrating the mind so that it's not on that to-do list. It's not on thinking of what's coming or what could happen or what you should have said three meetings ago. It's about, is this thought in service to my highest self and my ability to do my highest good? And I'm oversimplifying, I'm sure, in some ways. Talk a little bit about this idea of nirvana and of mind nakedness and maybe what we are mistranslating from Eastern to Western philosophy.
You know, it's interesting because there are two places where this attentiveness to getting things out of our mind takes place. One is in this meditation, yoga, Eastern philosophy context. And the other, interestingly enough, is in business organization schools of thought, things like getting things done or building a second brain, because what they want you to do is take all of the stuff that's in your mind and put them on a to-do list so that you don't have to think about them anymore. There are people who just walk around all day saying, don't forget this, and just constantly going over a script in their mind. And so we have to take these things out and put them on a piece of paper or a computer so that we don't forget them. Now, in business language, that's about being more productive and being more organized and being able to think about what you're doing. In this more Eastern approach and meditative approach, it's about, again, finding your higher self. What does that mean? That's the thing that we have trouble with. A lot of people think that their higher self is a more productive self, a more efficient self. How many people went into the pandemic thinking, oh, I'm going to write this book. Oh, I'm going to learn to make sourdough bread. Oh, I'm going to finally get fit. I'm going to do all those things. When we talk about what our higher self means, we tend to think of ourselves as project doers, as people who are goal-oriented. And the meditative approach wants us to be more in the moment, wants us to be in tune with our breathing, wants us to think about the feeling of air against our skin. Why? Because there is a great question on the table, which is it possible to think nothing but relaxing thoughts? Is it possible to have no idea-oriented thoughts and just be? If it is possible, it's incredibly difficult.
What does the word productive mean in each of those contexts?
That's a really good question. Productive in a business context means you are using the boss's money well, that you are efficient and that you're getting the job done. In the more personal meditative context, productive means you're building yourself. You're focusing on your health. You're focusing on your happiness. You're focusing on your moral core, what it means to be you in the world, in relationship to the world, and in relationship to other people. The problem is, especially right now, I don't know that we have any kind of consensus about what a moral self is, of what a higher self is. What is the person that we are building? Is it a good body? Is it physically healthy? Is it someone who can run a marathon? Is it someone who can educate their kids well? Is it someone who's a good partner? Or is it someone who is really focused on themselves and really focused on doing what they do best? Productive is a word that it is inherently built on the idea of labor, on work. You're producing things. The goal is what's important. You know, produce, the word we use for fruits and vegetables after it's out of the ground, is something that you can use, something that you can exploit in the neutral sense of the term exploitation. So even the very notion of producing ourselves implies that we have to do work to get a particular goal. So there has to be, if we want to step outside of that, there has to be another language, another set of words, another set of ideas that allow us to come to ourselves as a process, not as a product, as an ongoing person, not as something we want to show off to other people.
is there a Venn diagram between those? Because, yeah, I love me a good 3-hour restorative yoga followed up with a sauna and good night's sleep. But I also have things like a mortgage and a kid who's now in college.
It's funny you say that because Finland, the land of the saunas, they get a lot of work done in the sauna. And in the culture, men and women go to the sauna together, whether it's work context or personal context, because if you're not in the sauna, you're not there when the stuff gets done. For you, presumably, the sauna is not about business. It's not about making these social connections. It's about being present in your body and helping you sweat out the toxins and letting your muscles relax and all of these other things that, that saunas do. But it's also in the context of a progression. You start off with yoga, then you do the sauna, then you go get a night's sleep. It takes you hours to get to the point where you get to exhale and turn yourself off. Is there a way to turn ourselves off quickly and efficiently? This is what America demands. This is what Americans want. They want the ability to switch modes instantaneously. I turn on pop music, poof, I'm at a party. I turn on my noise machine, poof, I'm asleep. I turn on a movie, poof, I'm afraid or excited or aroused or whatever it is. Americans like to do things without transition. And that's one of the reasons why it's so hard for us to rest, because that's not how the body works and that's how not how the mind works. At least as you describe it, you have an account of how you take yourself from point A to point Z. But even for you who's practiced at a lot of this stuff, it takes a really long time.
Well, I wasn't anticipating this, but we could almost go in the direction of, okay, ChatGPT, taking out the process of being creative, or we could go this route of, should we be legalizing marijuana? That's certainly a shortcut to Zen moments at times. Do we dare want to tackle that in a few minutes?
Well, putting aside the question of legalization, one of the reasons why marijuana is so popular and many, many, many people smoke it or eat it or drink it, regardless of whether it's legal or not, the appeal of it is that you can choose the kind of experience you're having based on the kind of marijuana it is. There's relaxing marijuana, there's laughing marijuana, there's zoning out marijuana, there's just pain management marijuana. What marijuana does in the place of other pharmaceuticals or other drugs like alcohol is it starts with the material of our body first and then gets to the ideal, the mind second. Let me explain what that means, because there's a lot there. We exist in a dualistic society. We exist in a society that separates body from mind, where the body is our brain, the meat that's in our head, our muscles, and mind is this amorphous, abstract identity that we have, where we think about our thoughts and our experiences separate from the meat that, quote unquote, creates it. What antidepressants do, what marijuana does, what alcohol does, is say, I want to achieve a certain mood, so I'm going to deal with the meat first. I'm going to create a chemical reaction in my brain so that my body feels these relaxed things or these excited things or these unburdened lack of self-consciousness or things like that. I'm going to start with the meat first, and then my mind is going to be ushered along the way. What you were talking about when you were talking about yoga and asana and sauna is starting with the mind and having the mind adjust the body, starting with a perspective that is relaxed, a perspective that is inward, a perspective that is self-focused in a moral way, put that aside for now, and trying to push your body alongside it. And I think that when we have the material approach, the body to the mind, we have aids and it can take us, with that assistance, it can take us someplace quicker. But if we start with the mind and move to our body, it's a much more difficult space. Off the top of my head, I suspect the people who do that best are actors, people who can enter into a frame of
that.
Yeah, people who can take themselves and put them in a frame of mind of, at this moment I am lying in bed. At this moment I'm in love with someone. At this moment I'm running from, you know, Jason or Freddy. At this moment I am a different person. And by all accounts,
toddlers are also very good at this.
Toddlers are very good at this because one of the things that toddlers don't have a strong sense of is the distinction between imagination and reality. And that's also what actors are so good at making the imagination and reality permeable. If you go back to the Eastern traditions that you were talking about earlier, one of the things that many of them argue, and this is an oversimplification, is that our reality largely a product of our imagination. We see things as separate when they're not. We see things as distinct when they're really one. And what true enlightenment is not imagining the oneness, but getting rid of the forced imagination of day-to-day life until we surpass it, and then we've gained access to the world as it is. So toddlers and actors, they have a permeable imagination that they can expand to every part of their experience. And I can't do that anymore. I could, but I don't think I can do that anymore.
We're visiting today with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, a Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of North Dakota. And we are talking today about the philosophy of rest. And, you know, we have put a sort of singular spin on this, but we've gone back and forth between having this sort of Eastern approach, but being in a Western more capitalistic society. I want to kind of frame this conversation now from the perspective of the employer, because not getting just, let's focusing on sleep here. We're not talking about diet even or exercise, but not getting enough sleep causes poor concentration, slower reaction time, your ability to make a good decision. It impacts your performance, and that magical word, your productivity, also weakens your immune system. Seems like employers, am I right in saying it seems like there's an economic argument to be made for employers to want well-rested employees?
There is every reason to believe that employees who work 4 days a week are actually more productive than those who work five. And that's because people come more rested, more available, more energetic, and more focused. And so unless it's just plain factory work in which you're doing something very prescribed repetitively in the division of labor, anything that requires agency, anything that requires some sort of thought about the nature of the movement, the more rested, the healthier your employees are, the better off you are. And even in that factory work, that division of labor, the more rested you are, the less you are prone to injury, the less you're prone to messing up your back or messing up your shoulder or something like that. The question that we have to ask ourselves, and I keep going back to this Eastern approach, and I'll say why in just a second. The question we have to ask ourselves is, how do we think about who we are? Do we think about who we are holistically, as in our focus, our mood, our attitude, our knowledge, as well as our body, as well as our, you know, physical preference, presence in the office? Or do we think of ourselves just as cogs in a wheel? And what's concerning is how well we fit into the production that other people are a part of. I go back to the Eastern approach because all of Western philosophy grew alongside the emergence of capitalism, the emergence of industry, the emergence of a world where people are thought of in terms of employee and employer, in terms of production and that which is produced, as opposed to a larger, more individual, more, I don't know what the term is, but a more sacred self. And I use that word reluctantly because I don't necessarily want to mean it in a religious context. What I mean is that what we have lost is this idea that who we are as individuals should not be violated, should not be stepped on, should not be curtailed. That in all of the individualism that we talk about in terms of free speech, in terms of gun ownership, in terms of pursuing our own good and our own happiness, in all the terms of individualism that the philosophers have discussed for hundreds of years now, there's always a very narrow or thin notion of the self that can be poked and prodded by the world around them. And so the individual ceases to be sacred in the sense that it's the individual's experience that has to be respected more than their bodily autonomy. And that if you respect a person as an individual and their experience as an individual, then the questions of their bodily autonomy become very easy to answer. You don't violate people through assault. You don't violate people through hurting them. You don't violate people through taking away their education or their individual liberties or things like that. You let a person be who they are by virtue of them just being in the world. And again, we're not very good at that in our culture. We're not very good at being in the world. What we're really good at is absorbing other experiences. We're really good at going to the movies. We're really good to listening, you know, music to change our mood. We're really good at working out on our off days. We're really good at eating and enjoying the sensual pleasures of high fat and high sugar foods. We're really good at taking external objects and using them to move our experience in the way that they're directing us, but we're very bad at being self-directed in terms of fully realizing who we are as a self. And I think the place you see that most explicitly is in our current struggle for rest.
So are you saying that rest just doesn't even exist anymore?
I'm not saying that, but what I am saying is that we are individually responsible for our own rest. We can't expect other people to give it to us or to set up the parameters so that we realize it against our will. We as individuals are as responsible for our rest as we are for what we eat and how we exercise and how we show love and affection. We as individuals are responsible for ourselves first and foremost, and we have to establish boundaries just as we do with other aspects of our lives. The only way for us to find good, healthy rest is to establish strong boundaries and make sure that people don't cross them, even if sometimes that leads to making others upset or frustrated with us.
And maybe not assume that as soon as our daughter goes off to college, life isn't going to get any different anymore anyway.
Well, this is such a moment of crisis for me as we only have one daughter and I don't even know who I am without her anymore. But that might be a conversation for a few months from now.
Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, a Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of North Dakota. Thanks so much for your time today, and good luck on your journey to empty nesting.
I appreciate that, and I'm sure you will hear all about it.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. There is a distinct difference between the grass we grow on our lawns and grasslands. And some have considered the destruction of grasslands one of the worst ecological decisions we've ever made. Trees and shrubs are now overtaking what's left of the North American prairie. From the podcast Up From Dust, Celia Yopis-Jensen reports for Harvest Public Media.
If you're a rancher in the Flint Hills, the way to help the environment is by killing trees. So the mushrush family has killed maybe 10,000 of them in 3 years.
Elms are trouble. Eastern red cedars are maybe the worst.
Daniel Mushrush ranches on 15,000 acres in Chase County. This land used to be tree-free, but woody plants are moving in alarmingly fast.
So I knew it was happening on my ranch more than what it was, say, 20 years ago.
Some scientists call it the Green Glacier, a blanket of woodland and shrubland unfurling across the center of the country, making the prairie vanish.
It is disappearing right in front of our eyes.
Jesse Nippert is a grassland ecologist at Kansas State University. About one-third of North America used to be prairie. Most of that is now farms, but the Green Glacier is ravaging what's left.
These areas that have turned into juniper forests, we're probably not going to get them back. I think we protect what we can protect. We try and restore the areas that can be restored.
Junipers, called eastern red cedars, are gobbling grassland in Kansas, Nebraska, South Dakota, Missouri. Wild plum, sumac, and dogwood thickets are too, and they're making Great Plains wildfires harder to control. Troy Mueller is a captain with the Hutchinson Fire Department.
These cedars are very volatile. When they catch fire, they look like a Roman candle going off, and they will throw hot embers out, and they'll catch in the wind, and they'll spread the fire a quarter mile.
Red cedars, wild plum, these plants have been around for ages. Why are they spreading so much now, to the point that scientists say the Great Plains grassland biome is collapsing? Carbon dioxide is a key reason. More of it in the atmosphere helps woody plants beat out grasses. The forced removal of Native Americans from most of the Great Plains also paved the path to this Green Glacier. They burned grasslands regularly, for example, to attract bison to the extra nutritious regrowth. The European Americans who took over mostly did not. Woody plants are now so dominant that even ranchers like Mushrush, who do burn their land regularly, struggle to keep them away. Drac Twidwell is a rangeland ecologist at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, and he says the ranching industry is in trouble. He asks people to picture 1 billion pounds of grass rolled into those huge round hay bales.
You could line those up side by side from Kansas City, Missouri, and drive 9 hours seeing nothing but round bales all the way to Denver, Colorado.
That billion pounds you're picturing, it's how much more grass the region could grow each year if the Green Glacier hadn't eaten up so much prairie since the 1990s. Still, Twidwell says it's possible to save some of the prairie. The federal government has spent millions on tree removal over the years, but kind of triaging here and there.
We just have more and more and more sites to treat over time.
He advises the Natural Resources Conservation Service on its new, more systematic approach, the Great Plains Grassland Initiative. It's ramping up in Kansas, Nebraska, Oklahoma, and South Dakota to help ranchers secure bigger and bigger tree-free swaths of prairie. Ranchers like Daniel Mushrush in the Flint Hills. After 10,000 felled trees, he's nowhere near done. Sometimes it takes a whole afternoon to kill a dozen hard-to-reach trees.
It's a lot of old-fashioned chainsaw work, kind of walking rocky ridges and cutting down trees.
But he's seen more progress than ever, and it's a morale boost.
It's not easy work, but it's worthy work. At least we have a roadmap forward.
For Harvest Public Media, I'm Celia Yopis-Jepson.
That story comes to Harvest Public Media from the Kansas News Service and the Up From Dust podcast. Still to come on Main Street, celebrating Asian heritage.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Starian Bank, determined to provide smart banking solutions with innovative checking accounts and personal banking tools that match your lifestyle. Starian, taking you farther. Learn more at starianbank.com.
I like bagels.
Have some salad.
All I eat is pizza.
meat, some barbecue,
apple sauce, and some nice red beets.
All right, that means it's time for Prairie Plates with Rick Yeon. Rick, this is coming up on the end of Asian and Pacific American Heritage Month, honored every year in May. And there was a big capstone event with a big Asian market night. Tell us the sights, the sounds, most importantly, the flavors.
Yes, and again, good to be with you this week. And last Friday, I was at the third annual Asian Night Market at the Plains Art Museum, and it was packed. There is obviously high interest in those cultures, and especially the food, because talking to most of the food vendors, they sold out completely of everything.
Nice.
I talked to the owners of Saigon Cuisine, Namaste Kitchen. They, yeah, completely sold out. So,
just anecdotally, the crowd, was it mostly people of Asian descent? Was it a pretty good mix?
It was a very good mix, very diverse crowd. I think most people,
I mean, Asia itself is quite diverse.
Yeah, a lot of countries, a lot of cultures, yes. But diverse crowd. I think people, just talking with folks, they were interested mostly in eating because, yeah, a lot of good flavors there, and selling out kind of goes to show what the interest was. So, yeah, a very good event, and I wish them well in the future. I hope there's a fourth annual one. I know there's plans in the works, but K-Dog Korean Corn Dogs was supposed to show up. It was raining, so they decided not to.
They're a food truck. They need to be outside.
Right.
And
they were going to set up tables outside and all of that stuff and have a big kind of picnic sort of setting. But yeah, the rain kind of quashed all of that stuff, but still extremely popular event.
Yeah, well, let's hear a little bit from the project manager of this. This is Ann Nguyen. She is one of the main organizers of this. And Rick, you talked with her at the event just to kind of learn about how, yes, people are coming together over food, but it's really a showcase here of connection and
yes,
community.
Absolutely.
As an Asian community, we tend to not like to be in the spotlight, but we do acknowledge and we know that there is a booming community of Asian business owners, and this is by way serving as like multiple purposes. One is to provide a platform for Asian entrepreneurs to come out and showcase what they have to offer. And then as a secondary part, we celebrate Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month, which occurs and celebrated and recognized nationally every month of May. So it's a dual purpose, and we want to continue the tradition of spotlighting Asian American entrepreneurs, bringing the community together, because I think that's something that's really important around here. It's also a component that helps keep people in town and they feel like a place that they can belong and relate to and be a part of.
So, yes, I definitely want to be talking with you more about people coming together over food. But what you just said, there are lots of different business owners, entrepreneurs. Walk us through a little bit the sense that you got attending an event like that. You know, not specific to food in this case.
Well, yeah, and it's food is just one part of a culture, right? So
yeah.
you're talking arts, crafts, dance, music, all of that was integrated into this event. And I thought it for Fargo, it's very special event. And again, I do wish they continue it. I know there's plans to do that. And I'm guessing they may outgrow the Plains Art Museum because it was packed. It was hot in there. And I heard a little rumblings of them maybe expanding a little bit. So yeah, big success. But yeah, celebration of culture, and it's just a really good thing.
Nice. Well, what was the food like?
Very good. I got to try just a few things because I got there a little late and a lot of things had sold out. So I tried some spring rolls and from Knit Spring Rolls and then a stir fry from Saigon Cuisine. But that was from some friends of mine, and they were really hungry, so they didn't let me have a lot. But Anne actually made me one of her lychee teas, which was quite good and very refreshing. So, yeah, I did get a little dose of that. And I don't know. hopefully next year I'll get there a little earlier, I guess.
Yeah, note to self, you have to learn some of these things. You know, I'm interested because I think myself, like a lot of people, would sort of default to thinking like China, Japan, Korea. Like these are countries that come to mind very commonly as Asian countries. But, you know, technically, you know, Bhutan is a country in Asia. Technically, Pakistan is. There are nearly 50 countries making right. up this continent. Did you see any of those countries that are not the immediate sort of, it's the Philippines
right.
coming to mind?
Yeah, Namaste Kitchen, that's more in that Indian food realm. And yeah, and there were some Nepalese cultures represented there too. So not everything was in what you think. So it was very diverse. It was a very nice event. And again, I think they're going to start expanding things a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll probably see more cultures. And Fargo is very unique because of refugee resettlement. And a lot of refugees resettled in this region from dozens of countries. I'm not talking just a couple. It is like dozens. And I worked for refugee resettlement in the late 90s. That's where I picked up a lot of the flavors for the foods, as we've talked about before. And so Fargo is really not Fargo. It's a very diverse community. And it would be fun to see it expand and see where it's going to go in the future.
Where are some of the places where when you are craving Asian food, you are going to go? And always, listeners, send us your suggestions to plates@prairiepublic.org.
Yes, do that. We're always hungry here, especially for ethnic food because of the flavors. And speaking of food trucks, I really like Namaste Kitchen, Namaste Chai, Momos and More. That gets into that Nepalese area a little bit. I do like Jade Dragon, Sirareth, Thai, Little Brother. I have an article coming out in the High Plains Reader about Thai Coda. There are a lot of choices in Fargo-Moorhead. And in Bismarck and Grand Forks, those choices are growing, too. House of Punjab and Grand Forks is quite good. There is a really good Indian restaurant in downtown Bismarck that I've been to quite a few times. The Thai food scene in Bismarck is quite strong. So we're seeing a real bloom of ethnic restaurants, and it's just good to go and try. I just like those flavors.
Yeah.
Explore.
Yeah. Do you get any good cooking tips on things like this?
I do, and I've actually given a few cooking tips to about how to cook rice noodles appropriately for pad thai.
Okay. Fascinating.
Yeah, because you need to soak them in kind of lukewarm water, not hot water. Some restaurant was boiling them and then they get really gummy. But for the most part, I get tips from them. And
yeah, I would hope so.
You know, TJ and Gina at Thai Coda were just in Thailand for like a month, and they picked up all sorts of goodies and curry paste and techniques and stuff. So I've been kind of hounding them for some Thai tips that are straight from Thailand, some really hardcore, authentic ideas. And so it's really fun to talk to some of these restaurant owners about.
Yeah. Well, you know, there are a number of sort of international flavor spotlights events that aren't even specific to Asia at all. I understand you also go to things like the International Potluck.
Yeah, I like those international potlucks quite a bit that are in town in Fargo here. They're at the Indigenous Association quite often, which is in downtown Fargo. But a big event was just about a week and a half ago at the Neighborhood Church, which is in the Golden Ridge area, a diverse population in that neighborhood. And that was a very popular event. I'd say 100 people were there, and probably from at least 10 or 12 different cultures, different foods. Maria's Homestyle made some really good tacos, and there was other potluck foods that people brought too, and it was just a really, really fun event.
Yeah, well, I want to go back to what you were saying, that you used to work for Refugee Resettlement, and that's really what got you interested in food. And so many events like this are kind of designed around teaching about culture and stuff, because everybody eats, and it's very easy to say, hey, let's all come together over a plate of delicious food and then learn like all of the things that we have in common and can share, and then what are the unique attributes that different cultures, we can celebrate each other. Just anecdotally, in the years that have elapsed between when you were first working in Refugee Resettlement to now, are you noticing a big change in attitudes and understanding and just sort of cultural awareness and appreciation?
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's important to note that in a political climate such as now, where things are very I don't know what the right word for it is. And it's just, I think food brings people together. It's something that bridges those differences. And it's important for people to gather and eat together and talk to each other about different cultures and different ways of life, because then we start to understand each other and we understand the world better.
All right. Rick Gian, I couldn't have said it better myself. Thanks, Rick.
You bet.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Bill Dean, Realtor with Better Homes and Gardens, Real Estate Alliance Group of Bismarck, serving the Bismarck-Mandan area from homes and ranches to rental properties. More information at BillDeanHomes.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. The Institute for Regional Studies has been around since 1950. It works to instill a regional identity in the Great Plains. Today, in this Plains Folk essay from historian Tom Ezern, we hear about the guy who got the ball rolling.
In 1949, a new dean arrived to head up the School of Applied Arts and Sciences at North Dakota Agricultural College. Not one from the customary Midwestern lineage for North Dakota Agricultural College appointees. The press said he was a native Texan, but his name didn't sound like it. Gustav Ernst Giesecke. If you read the notices further, you learned that he hailed from Marble Falls, Burnett County, in the central Texas hill country. And then it makes sense, since German immigrants figured prominently in the settlement of the hill country. The historian Fred Lubke wrote a wonderful book about them called German Seed on Texas Soil. The Giesecke family was a learned bunch and exceedingly German. The immigrant patriarch, Johann Friedrich Ludwig Albert Giesecke Sr., had a white beard that draped to his waist. It was when I found a photo of his son, Walter Christian Giesecke, the father of the future Dean Giesecke, that I commenced making historical connections. Walter is a dashing-looking German rancher with a devilish goatee and a stockman's brimmed hat, but a hat blocked in the style of a German country hat. The connection I grasped was how it happened that Walter's son Ernst in 1950 would found at North Dakota Agricultural College the oldest regional studies center on the Great Plains of North America, the Institute for Regional Studies. The Institute, still a going concern, will celebrate its 75th anniversary in the year 2025, and so I'm looking into its origins, because I realize that the formation and persistence of this research center in North Dakota is part of a larger concern sometimes referred to as the Regional Project, by which I mean the instillment in the hearts and minds of people on the prairies of the sense that they live in a distinctive place, much larger than local. A continental region that came to be known as the Great Plains. Molly Rosen has written a fine book called Grasslands Grown that identifies the origins of a sense of place among girls and boys who grew up on the prairies a century or more ago, and tells how, as they went into the world, they met other prairie girls and boys and concluded their common experience meant something. To articulate and refine that experience into a regional identity was the regional project. And it required artists, writers, scholars to accomplish it. Indeed, the very phrase Great Plains did not enter common American usage until the Texas historian Walter Prescott Webb published his landmark book, The Great Plains, in 1931. The regional project, like the range cattle industry, arose in central Texas and percolated northward. Webb, and perhaps even more so the folklorist J. Frank Dobie, anchored the project at the University of Texas. The statesmanlike editors of the University of Oklahoma Press, Joseph Brandt and Savoy Lawtonville, gave the Great Plains voice on the other side of the Red River of the South. A generation later, Ernst Giesecke brought the regional project to the Red River of the North. This was after he had taken his degrees, culminating in an extremely esoteric dissertation in German linguistics at Stanford. Completed a fellowship in Germany, served a wartime stint in the United States Navy, and held some previous academic appointments. To my knowledge, Giesecke, unlike Elwin Robinson at the University of North Dakota, who did, Giesecke never wore a broad-brim hat to the NDAC campus. But I do.
Dr. Tom Easern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. Dakota Datebook is next.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 29th. May is National Historic Preservation Month, and today we hear about another historic structure involved with North Dakota's transportation infrastructure. In 1919, the Scobie Oil Company, owned by R.J. Dick Coughlin, consolidated with the Gray Lindeman Company to become the Westland Oil Company. This Montana business soon expanded into North Dakota, especially in the north-northwest. In 1927, the company decided to move its headquarters from Scobie, Montana, to Minot. In March of 1928, Minot welcomed the new industry, along with the 44 new people who relocated to the city. At that time, Minot had three large service stations, plus a service pump that was maintained night and day at the Citizens Garage. However, there was discussion of building a super service station near the end of Central Avenue. And around 1929, a gas station in the domestic style was constructed at 510 East Central Avenue. This cozy house-like structure near Eastwood Park evoked feelings of home and comfort. It also reflected the Tudor Revival-style buildings of the nearby neighborhood. Today, this building is listed in the National Register of Historic Places. Articles about the Westland Oil Filling Station and its employees were common in the local newspapers, including photos of the staff, company reports, and descriptions of how the oil was blended. One article boasted that the company had its own business airplane, a Ryan Airlines monoplane constructed in San Diego. By 1930, in order to provide greater service to its patrons, it was reported that the company also arranged that telegrams could be received at Westland service stations. Coughlin, the head of Westland Oil, got very involved in the community and appeared regularly in newspaper articles, including the Bismarck Tribune in 1937, which reported that he had provided and personally showed motion pictures of a North Dakota roundup, which he had taken on a McKenzie County ranch. Interestingly, Peter Dipong, an oil compounder for the company, previously worked as a Canadian Pacific Railway chef. Alongside his other duties at Westland, he provided meals for special events like conventions and meetings. In 1931, he and Coughlin prepared a venison dinner procured during a hunting trip south of Williston. The paper reported that they cooked enough for 100, but the 56 in attendance let none of it go to waste. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Sarah Walker. I'm Ann Alquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota. That's it for this Wednesday edition of Main Street. On today's All Things Considered, student interest in agriculture is growing. We learn about access to equipment and land, though, that's making it difficult. And on Travel with Rick Steves, how travelers get together and discuss serendipity. And tomorrow on Main Street, a tiny town in Minnesota that puts on a full-scale Italian opera. We talk to the documentary filmmaker behind Iron Opera. That's tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.